Well, welcome to retreat. I'm really eager to get started, to be back in retreat, to spend most of the next 4 days actually in practice. And so I just want to very briefly and in a way that can never express the gratitude that I feel to Mary Kay for, first of all, suggesting this and then insisting on this more than a year ago. And that's how long it takes, you know, to actually pull an event like this together, have to reserve it and all of that. And then Rick and Lindsay and What Do You Think, Inc. jumped in and took care of much of the logistics. And so the three of them made a tremendous team. And then they filled out their team, of course, with all of the people that they relied on to put this together in this beautiful location. And so I am just delighted to be here. And it feels like to me, a very special few days that we're going to be spending together, because we have, for many of us anyway, have been practicing together for some time. And we at least are all very familiar and steeped in this lineage of Alan Wallace, Dujum Lingpa. And so it's really for the retreats that I've been doing in the last couple of years, this is really unique in that I feel for really the first time, maybe ever, that I don't have to start at the beginning and try to describe the entire path of Dzogchen in a few days, you know, and to really compress things and to try to teach the whole path of Shamatha in a weekend, which you can remember that I've done that, right? And it's, you know, I think it's helpful to do that, but I think now we're ready to go on based on your years of experience now with these teachings of Shamatha, Vipassana, and the view of Dzogchen. And for those of you who maybe aren't that familiar as what I just described, I think that, you know, again, it will be, you'll be able to just jump right in and follow the progression. But hopefully there will be nuances, some different insights, different emphases of practice, different ways of thinking of the relationship of Vipassana and Shamatha that may open some new doors for you as well in your practice and keep it exciting. So this retreat, like all of the other retreats that I have done, takes the form of short frequent sessions. So this is what all of the Dzogchen masters, or I should say the Shamatha masters, have described as the key for actually achieving Shamatha is short frequent sessions. And so the question then is how short and how frequent? And the answer, one of the classic answers, is that you start with, here's the bedrock answer to that. So we're going to be doing 24-minute sessions because it is in a sweet spot. But in a two-month retreat that I just taught at Tosam Ling Nunnery near Dharamsala, we actually started with six-minute sessions, started a two-month meditation period session, you know, knowing that we had a long time to go into it. Because I started off with 12-minute sessions and I could see that people weren't ready for it. Because many of the people were fairly new to practice, some of them were entirely new to Shamatha. And so 6 minutes was a good way to start. So the answer for that question of how short then, the answer that the masters give is that you quit while you still want to meditate. So you should just ask yourself that. Is my meditation the length of time that I have set aside for my practice or the amount of time that I put on my timer? Is it beginning to feel like drudgery at the end? Am I just training myself to laxity or to excitation? Or is this what the real point of this guideline is, quality over quantity? And so, yeah, so short frequent sessions. So the shortness, the sweet spot that we are going to use in this retreat is 24 minutes. This was the advice of Master Kamala Shila that Lama Tsongkhapa cites in the Lamrim Chenmo Volume 3 when asked that question, how long? And so 24 minutes is this 1/60th of the day. So instead of 24 60-minute periods, in ancient India, the number of drops falling out of a glass beaker, they had timed at 24 or 60 24-minute periods. So for a meditator, that is a period that is not too long, in that you're not going to just sit there and be spaced out or sit in pain or just your mind starts wandering, and then that you spend, if you set off trying to do an hour-long session and 45 minutes of your session is just wandering or you're fighting drowsiness, you're not really training the mind. And you can do that for years and years and years, and I think that a lot of us have experience with this, and not really make any progress in developing stability and vividness. And so this short period of 24 minutes is a nice enough time so that it's not too long, but it is long enough so that you can really begin to experience the deepening of your meditation from beginning to end, because it's not uncommon that when you first sit down, your mind is really distracted and there is a lot of momentum, there's a lot of turbulence. And as you just continue to practice through even a 24-minute period, you notice a difference between the degree of turbulence from the moment that you started to when you finished. And then the beauty of having a situation like we have for the next 4 days is that we don't have to stop with one gatka and then go to work or get busy. So now we can really devote our entire days to really finding an optimal practice for ourselves. And so one of the things that you may notice, so we have our schedule, and might as well just look at that. So we're going to begin. Basically, the entire day is going to allow us to spend the entire day, the full day of practice. And so the full day of practice begins at 6:30 a.m. with an optional session of morning prayers. And so I'm going to be here for those morning prayers, and we'll go over those morning prayers. And this is an extraordinary, and I'll talk more about the morning prayers, I hope, at the end of this evening, because really these morning prayers are just one of the most extraordinary lines of philosophical, spiritual verse that I have ever encountered. And it really encapsulates the whole path of Dzogchen in a few lines. And so to start off your day of practice with these lines and actually doing practice with them is unbelievable. And then we have two silent gatkas after that. And even though you might not be a morning person, so these are optional. If you decide that, you know, it's most beneficial for your retreat to do your morning practice in your room, that's fine. Or if you decide that it's most beneficial for you to stay in bed and catch up on your sleep until breakfast, that's a decision that you make that is based on what is the best that I can do for myself in this to get the most out of this retreat. But for many of us that come to that session, these might be your favorite sessions of the day, because those two gatkas after basically generating yourself as Padmasambhava, those are extraordinary sessions. And then the rest of the day is going to be what I am hoping to do, because you all have a good amount of experience with meditation. I am hoping to not talk endlessly and just on and on. And what I'm trying to do is I will try to find a balance between giving you just enough instruction and background and context to do the next practice, and then to allow enough time in the practice, because, you know, we've all frankly heard a lot of teachings. We've all read a lot of books. And so it's not likely that I'm going to say anything that is totally new to you or earth-shaking. And instead, the most valuable thing for you is going to be actually maybe hearing something that is inspiring and then putting that immediately into practice. And so the one thing that all of us are missing in our lives is just the opportunity to practice maybe as much as we want to or as much as we would, you know, would really benefit us. So here we have the opportunity to do that. And so it is up to you to determine for yourself what is the optimal approach for you to get the milk this opportunity and get the most out of this retreat. When I spent almost 3 months in India this winter at Dharamsala, and a little over 2 months of that, almost 2.5 months, actually, 2.5 months, more than 2.5 months, I was at Tosam Ling Nunnery and leading a 2-month retreat there. But one of the great things about that jaunt to India was that Lama Allen was teaching a 7 or 8 day retreat at Tushita, which is a well-known retreat center at Dharamsala also. So my trip began with this 8-day retreat with Lama Allen, and there were a number of the people that were at my retreat that were also at Lama Allen's retreat. And so at the very end of the retreat, of Lama Allen's retreat, one of the young women who was going to be at my retreat asked him, what advice do you have for those of us who are going to be doing this 2-month retreat with Doug? And he said, it was very straightforward and succinct. He said, relax. And then he went on to say, again, you know what the whole rationale of that is. And that is in Dzogchen, you give up striving, because striving involves a state of mind that we are hoping to see through and transcend. And so what you are doing is basically relaxing into the natural state of the mind and discovering what is there underneath or beyond all of the striving and the conceptualization that creates goals for ourselves and who we are, who is the striver. So relax, the point being, again, quality over quantity. And so you decide then in this schedule, you'll see that we have periods where of instruction. So at 9 o'clock, there is a period of 1.5 hours where I will be giving you, you know, laying out a new practice, giving you the context for it, some basic instruction for it. And then we'll have a break in there, and then we'll do a 24-minute guided meditation all within that 1.5 hour period. But that then is followed by, the morning, I actually changed that. I had more instruction in, so this is the third iteration of this schedule that I sent Mary Kay to print. And the first two had another session in the morning that was only going to be a 15-minute session and another, or 12-minute and 12-minute. But I decided that was too much also. So I wanted to give you the experience of having this beautiful period of 3 ghatkas in a short retreat without junking it up with more instruction, so that you can really begin to experience the deepening effect of what I think of as ganging up ghatkas. So you'll notice that, you know, you'll reach a point of stability. Usually it's the stability that you notice, the improvement or the deepening of the stability. So the first one, your mind could be agitated. You know, you're bringing to the session a lot of thought. You've just been tuning into the news. You know, you've had discussions with your family or whatever. So all of that is replaying naturally. So it's nothing to be disturbed about. This is the way that the mind works. But in the absence of shaking the jar, the muddy water that's in the jar just begins to settle out. So this is what happens over a period in the ghatakas, when you're ganging together ghatakas especially. It happens within a 24-minute period, but it definitely happens when you put together these periods, you know. So we'll have, you know, a long period of meditation in the morning, really with a guided meditation. So you do, if we do three sessions before breakfast, and then another guided session, and then three sessions, you know, you're already up to seven ghatakas by lunch. So this is, I think, where you can really begin to experience the benefit and the transformational power of these practices. And then, but the point, remember Lama Allen said relax was the first point. And so for you then, in your relaxed way of deciding for yourself, rather than what's going to impress people or thinking that there are hall monitors or something here that are taking attendance and seeing who's here and who's not here, or I'm taking names, you know, I see there are only six people here in the morning, you know, so those become my favorites, you know. So it's not like that. You decide in this relaxed way what is going to benefit your 4 days here. And because I know that you're all very highly motivated, you know, it took a lot of motivation. You had to give up a lot to change your schedules to, you know, it took a lot of to get here. So I'm not worried about your motivation. So, you know, just you decide what is going to be the best, what is going to give you the most. And then also just be open to the possibility that you may be stagnating a bit in your comfort zone. And so be willing to, you know, just push that a bit, you know, and you don't have to overdo it, but you can just be open to that possibility, you know, in looking at your own experience. And so you have then, Lama Allen said, relax, you figure out what's optimal for you. So in these, wherever there are periods here on the schedule that are listed as silent ghatka sessions, those, like the morning prayers, you know, the three sessions before breakfast, are entirely optional. You figure out what's best for you. And it could be that what's best on one day will be different, you know, than what's best on other days. And so it could be that you need to go for a walk during one of these ghatka periods because you're feeling a little lax. You're feeling dull. So you know that a walk down to the lake in this invigorating weather is going to really set you up for the next sessions on the cushion. But the point is that we are practicing all day long. So whether you are on the cushion here in this room, on the cushion in your room, or you are between sessions, Tibetans always say there are two meditation periods. There is the period of your meditation on the cushion, and then there is the period between sessions on the cushion. And both are equally important. And so here, especially when we get into Vipassana practice, and there's no reason that it can't be Shamatha practice also. This is a full-time experience, and there's no reason that you can't be practicing from now until you drive out the driveway on Tuesday. And that should just be your aspiration and your intention, because this is basically an easy laboratory. If you can do that here, then you have a better chance of learning an attitude about your practice that you can take back to you with your home, your families, your workplace, etc. And we'll go into that in much more detail, the techniques for doing that. So the other thing then that Lama Allen said, there were 2 points for Sophie's question. How do we get the most out of this retreat? First of all, relax and give up striving. Because if you basically insist on results when you come into this retreat and you're just going to push until you get those results, you're going to burn out. So you might not burn out in a 4-day retreat, you know, but it's possible. But definitely in longer retreats, you know, if you're just insisting on results and you're just really hammering and pushing, and that you're just setting yourself up for burning out. And the burnout can definitely happen in, you know, a couple of weeks for sure. So the other point that Lama Allen had of advice for Sophie was to always keep recalling that there is nothing you would rather be doing. So it really is just keeping in mind what an extraordinary opportunity this is. And just keep rejoicing that, you know, you made the decision to get yourself here. So, I mean, that's something to be really happy about. You know, all of the other things that were competing for your attention, your time, your money, you know, you decided that this was important to do. And then there is these practices, when you really immerse yourself in them, they yield results really quickly in a sense of well-being. And I think that's just a really common experience. And so it's very easy, frankly. And this, you know, people will turn a corner in their practice when they reach this point, but it can happen pretty quickly that you reach this point where there is just nothing you would rather be doing. And so I can remember when one of my good friends, this was long ago, used to say, this is better than the best day of powder skiing. And this guy was a powder skiing hound. And I was never the powder skiing hound that this guy was, or maybe still is. But I would say the same thing, that this is better. So given a choice right now, and I actually have faced this choice numerous times in the past few years, of what would I rather be doing? You know, sitting on the beach at my favorite island in Thailand, doing that and snorkeling, diving, whatever, or staying in my room and meditating. I have a choice. I can do whatever I want. I think I'm just going to sit here or lie here and practice. Why? Because I just came off a 2-month retreat with Alan Wallace in Phuket, and I can't think of anything I want to do but just continue to practice. When you reach that point, and you can, you know, probably many of you have reached that point in your practice, there's no discipline required to practice. And it becomes this full day affair, because what else are you going to do that is more enjoyable, frankly? So just, those are the 2 points that of Lama Allen's advice. Let's just say that he's was giving that advice to us also. So chill out, relax, enjoy yourself, and then just keep recalling, there's nothing I would rather be doing. And just really seize the essence of this. And one way of seizing the essence is going to be by maintaining silence. And so this is something that you're, a gift that you're giving yourself, because it's very difficult in our busy modern lives to access pristine awareness, let alone substrate consciousness, or I should say substrate consciousness, let alone pristine awareness. And one of the reasons for that is that we keep filling every quiet moment with stimulation. And so it is, you know, it's just so common wherever you are in the world now. It doesn't matter whether you are, you know, in Boston or if you are walking on a path in northern India where the rice fields are still plowed by water buffalo. where people are spending a lot of time on their cell phones. You know, and you can see monks walking down one of these bucolic pastoral scenes, you know, with the Himalayas or the Daladar range rising 17,000 feet in steep escarpment right behind these paddies. And you'll see monks just engrossed in their cell phones. So this is a worldwide phenomena now, that people are filling up every possible moment of silence with stimulation. So it's really rare for people to voluntarily submit to a situation where they have to, because of an absence of stimulation, simply recognize what's going on in their own minds, because mostly people are fleeing that recognition. You know, they're escaping that recognition, filling it up with somebody else's ideas, with media stimulation, media engagement. So part of the one element of silence is that conversation, and you really begin to notice this after a period of silence, that conversation really engages the conceptual mind. And you begin to recognize that you don't know what's coming out of your mouth until it's said, you know? And what comes out of your mouth can be really, really surprising. Oftentimes, when you have just spent a long period of time in silence, and then you begin to talk, you realize how inane so much of your conversation is, and that the things that you're actually saying don't represent your view. You know, a lot of it is just they're cliches and making the other person feel comfortable, and especially if you're not talking to somebody about Dharma. You know, you're all just kind of in this self-confirming world of stupid conceptual reification. You know, and it's difficult to talk, so you'll notice that after a period of silence. So give yourself the gift, then, of really enhancing the possibility of experience of non-conceptuality by remaining silent. And that means with vocal speech. And so you're giving yourself this gift, but it's also in a group, in a community. This is the only way that other people are going to be able to experience silence as well and non-conceptuality, is if everybody participates. And so I'm asking all of you to not say another word from tomorrow morning when you wake up until sometime on Tuesday morning. And so there will be a period about midway through Tuesday morning. So Tuesday morning breakfast and the morning sessions of the before breakfast and breakfast will still be silent. So I'm asking you not to choose your speech wisely, but just don't say another word for that period. And if you, so that's my request. And if you choose to, and you have some good reason to, then just, you know, weigh this in your mind. Doug said, or requested, you know, don't say a word. I need to say a few words tonight, whatever, you know. I need to check in. If you have people that you are relying on you, for instance, and you need to make phone calls or something like that, okay, but you know, do it. You know, realize what you're giving up and do it. You know, dedicate, I guess, the sacrifice. But don't do it unless you absolutely have to. And definitely, give up your phones. At Toshida and at Tosam Ling, I was really amazed. They did it old school, where when you registered, you had to check in your cell phones and your computers and every media device that you had. They put it in a safe, you know, registered it, envelopes and all of that. But they were, you know, really serious about it. They confiscated all of your devices. So just consider that your devices have been confiscated. And if absolutely you need to, you know, then okay, but, you know, please, if you don't, if there's any way that you don't need to, and it could be if you are told somebody that you would check in every few days or something like that, maybe just tonight let them know that this will be your last opportunity until Tuesday. It really is going to make a difference for you. So silence. And if you absolutely need to talk to somebody, you know, and you feel like it's going to enhance your experience somehow, and there are two consenting adults, then go for a walk. Take it out of the building, off the grounds, so people not only won't hear you, but they won't see you talking. So that's my request. And it pays dividends. You will be so happy that you have done that. And so many people, again, you know, it never fails. There were a lot of people in this two-month retreat. You know, there were 33 people from all over the world, ranging from 18 to 80. And there were people who were new to meditation, new to Buddhism, certainly new to longer retreats. And a lot of people at the very beginning were apprehensive about staying silent for that long. And then at the end, predictably, they didn't want to talk. They thought that was one of the most powerful parts of the experience. And one of the things that you'll notice also, and this really applies to longer retreats, you know, so this, hopefully you will leave here at the end of 4 days, Tuesday, it's either 5 days or 4 days, but, you know, 3 days plus two half days, it makes 4 days in my mind. But so you leave here with the confidence actually to do the thinking that you know exactly how to organize, run, and you have the practices to do your own longer retreats. And what you notice, and you may notice that in this length of a retreat also, but you definitely notice this in retreats of longer than 10 days, and then what I really noticed was longer than a month, is that there's something about the time itself where you have just stopped ingesting all of this stimulation, that the retreat itself just begins to do miraculous work on you. And your stability and vividness just naturally kind of begin to flower. And it's sometimes you think that it's not even due to the practice that you're doing, but it's simply being in retreat and not filling your mind up with this junk. And so this is why people go into isolated situations. And because they have recognized the power of the situation itself to be really transformative. So in these days together, we are going to be exploring a few texts, but we're not really going to be, I'm just going to be citing these texts. It's certainly, you know, I don't attempt to do word commentaries like Lama Allen does, you know, to choose a text and then just explicate every word in the text, you know, so I'm not a scholar, and he's the master of doing that. So what I tried to do is just to extract a few things out of the retreats that I have been so bountifully gifted to do with Lama Allen, and a number of you have also, and just to take out some of the things that have been especially beneficial as I apply them in my own practice, and as I have taught them to other people in retreat, and seeing the response that there is to these particular approaches or twists, or just highlighting these few things. So this is what we're going to do in this retreat. So we're going to really limit the focus of the practices that we're going to be doing to our focus is going to be the four modes of mindfulness. And I'll explain a lot more about that, what these practices are. But tomorrow we will actually be doing breath meditation, but we're only going to be working with awareness, not attention, in our breath meditation. So we're all this retreat then, we'll go right into bringing that awareness in from the object of the breath or tactile sensations of the breath to appearances to the mind or within the space of the mind. And then be using what really just kind of occurred in Tosam Ling was this realization of this very natural approach to doing Vipassana within the four modes of mindfulness that is very powerful and very deeply connected to non-meditation and resting in pristine awareness. So all of these practices come from this crazy cat on the cover, Dujam Lingpa, who is the founder of this lineage, of the Dujam lineage, who was born in 1835 and died in 1904. So it's just amazing to me that this extraordinary teacher, Dzogchen Yogi, and teacher Mahasiddha, lived in the 20th century. So, you know, he's not really contemporary, but he's modern. So as modern as Tibet was at that point anyway. So 1835 to 1904, and every time I say, you know, 1904, I can't help but think that there is some correspondence between the time of his death and the really the beginning of the end for Tibet, which was the British invasion of the Young Husband expedition from India that shot its way into Lhasa, killing thousands of Tibetans along the way, stringing telegraph lines all the way from the Indian border all the way to Lhasa so that newspaper reporters could send back daily dispatches from the front. And that was what really led the Dalai Lama, so the 13th Dalai Lama, to go into exile, first in Mongolia and then in Nanjing, I think it was the capital of China at that time. And that really was, in my mind, the beginning of the end. And so this Dujam Lingpa is just one of the most extraordinary figures in Tibetan Buddhism that I just begin to find more and more awe for this teacher the more I learn about him. And one of the things that I hope to do in our evening sessions is, so we'll have in our 1.5 hour evening sessions, we'll have a guided meditation and then followed by my responses, if not my answers, to your written questions. And so in those questions, again, don't follow Mary Kay's advice and try to stump the chump. You know, because that only works on car talk. And it's really easy to stump this chump, you know. So, you know, you don't have to feel vain about, you know, asking a question that I don't have an answer for. I would appreciate it if you would confine your questions to material that we've covered or to your experience in meditation. And write those questions down. You don't have to put your name on, you can if you want. But you know, the written questions, I think, are really helpful in that they give you a chance to frame your question. They don't require you to talk. You can really be deliberate and think through your question. And you can ask the question without a lot of ego invested in it. You know, how's my voice sounding? You know, does this sound intelligent? You know, you can ask it in total anonymity. But please try to confine it to what we've covered, or your experience, or observations, etc., with your experience in meditation. And if there are questions and there is time, you know, questions that are just kind of general in nature about Buddhism, or what is the difference between Shentong and Rongtong, you know, those I might put, that one might actually put up closer because it's interesting. But, you know, those might go towards the end of a pile of questions. But anyway, you get the idea of keeping your questions relevant to our experience here. But what I'm hoping also is to have a few minutes at the end of each of these evenings, after tonight, to read to you a little bit, a bedtime story from the autobiography of Dujom Lingpa, which appeared to me as a terma, actually, almost in Tosam Ling, because this was a text that Lama Allen hasn't taught. I was totally unaware of its existence. And I was, in preparation for a class, I had typed a word in the search, you know, at the top bar that searches your entire computer, and the top hit came up this book, Traktung. And so I thought, Traktung, what is this? I clicked on the icon, and it was Traktung, the autobiography of Dujom Lingpa, the visionary autobiography. And so I had never actually heard about this. Lama Allen had apparently referred to it in appendices of some of his books, but I've never heard him talk about this in the classes. You know, what we know of Dujom Lingpa's memoir comes in Mud and Feathers and Buddhahood Without Meditation. But this Traktung is unbelievable. So I hope to read to you some passages from this that just give you, well, just your jaw will drop and will give you some appreciation for what he has given to us here. And one of the interesting things, I don't know if I should give it away, but really one of the interesting things about this, you know, so I mentioned how Dujom Lingpa just feels so modern because he lived into the 20th century. But one of the things that, maybe I'll just leave it. Well, he keeps mentioning, there are, in all of these, the Dakinis that appear to him, the Mahasiddhas, Padmasambhava, Yeshe Sogyal, many of them talk about the imminent demise of Buddhism, of Dharma, and of the great perfection in Tibet. You know, imminent. And how important it is to really get these teachings out before the barbarians invade. And they talk, and these prophecies talk, so a lot of these would have been in the 1870s, probably. But they talk about, so I have all of these. Whenever the barbarians are mentioned, I you know, highlighted this in my Kindle. So I have, there are references from the south, so which would have been the British from India. And then there are many references to the Chinese barbarians and how fragile the great perfection was, and how important it was to really teach this well so that it would survive the barbarian hordes that were about to bring an end to the golden period in Tibet. So here we have it. Here we have it. And so there's a lot more to that also. And the story that we'll begin with tomorrow night then actually begins with a conversation between Padmasambhava and Yeshe Sogyal talking about bringing this cat from who's hanging out in this pure land, bringing him back to earth to teach the great perfection because the times were demanding, you know, the time was short. So it's really, so that's where the story starts, where we'll pick up the story tomorrow. And it really gives you a sense of how powerful and how important what we're doing here is, because we are fulfilling, in a sense, we are safely transplanting here into our own culture this mission, you know, that Dujam Lingpa was given by Padmasambhava, you know, not that long ago. So Dujam Lingpa, you know, so it's said many times in these mind treasures that these teachings would be so important for people of the future. Sometimes also there are references that these teachings would be especially important in the cities of the West. These, you know, his visions are just filled with these prophecies. So here we are. So we're going to begin as Dujam Lingpa did in his whole explication of the path, beginning with shamatha practice. So the essence of the practice basically is shamatha, vipassana, and then trekcha, cutting through, and then tukyel, the direct crossing over. So this is the streamlined essence that Dujam Lingpa outlines in the great text that Lama Allen has translated. So, you know, Lama Allen, you know, just think of the importance when we hear about the mission that Dujam Lingpa is given, the assignment that he's given by Padmasambhava directly, and he's reluctant to undertake. It's really interesting, and you know, gratifying and a little, again, awe-inspiring to think of the role that our teacher, Alan Wallace, has played in this. So these teachings, you know, that I'm just going to skim are all teachings that Alan heard and translated when he was serving as the principal translator for Gyatro Rinpoche during so he did that for about 18 years, or he, you know, but there were a 5-year period, I believe it was, when Gyatro Rinpoche was really teaching this particular set of teachings that all became the 3 volumes then that Wisdom Publications published as Dujam Lingpa's Visions of the Great Perfection. And this is what Lama Allen is teaching in this whole series, 7 years of 8-week retreats in Tuscany. And then he also, there were a couple of other absolutely extraordinary texts that he taught, also on Mahamudra. So Lama Allen, Gyatro Rinpoche taught these, Gyatro Rinpoche being extraordinary Nyingma Lama, the throne holder, you could say, or deputized throne holder of the Nyingma order in North America, asked by Dujam Rinpoche to come here, a lineage holder in both Mahamudra and Nyingma, absolutely extraordinary teacher. So Lama Allen translated this, and then they collaborated then on several volumes anyway of the written translation, going over it word by word to make sure that this was right, you know. So this was a big publishing event, and this, all of these teachings that Lama Allen is doing, I think I just am beginning to really feel the historic import of all of that. And so, you know, what we're doing also, I think, has this really historic import because it is this very powerful way for, and it is one of the things that is makes these teachings so contemporary is that you don't have to really adopt any belief system. You just run experiments and check out the results of your experiments with other people who are running the same experiment, and then understand that what your results within a big context, and then see what is this nature of the mind? You know, can it be discovered directly with using these practices? So this is why these seems so contemporary, I think, because it's very scientific. You just, rather than having to adopt a lot of medieval from symbolism and meanings from medieval India, like a lot of Tantra is, you know, it's very overtly conceptual, you know, and filled with and intended to be all of this medieval symbolism. But this Dzogchen doesn't have any of that. It's just very stripped down, very lean, working with your own mind and trying to understand and discover what is the nature of my own experience of my own mind, and can I actually discover its ultimate nature in my direct experience? So, and it's all just very pragmatic, very empirical, and you know, so it really lends itself, I think, to a modern mind that has this scientific framework or this approach of the scientific values of objectivity, research, collaboration, checking your results with other people who are doing the same thing. So the path begins with shamatha, but the path even before shamatha, the entire path begins with the preliminaries. And so these are just something to not forget or think that we have achieved or thought about these 2 years ago, or you know, you read a book on renunciation or something like that. These preliminaries are something, these are called in Mud and Feathers, which the full title of that, of course, is The Foolish Dharma of an Idiot Clothed in Mud and Feathers. But we'll just call that Mud and Feathers for short. So this is the spiritual memoir of Dujom Lingpa, and he said, this is how, basically at the end of his life, this is what I did to travel this path. And so, you know, he really just gets right down to the highlights of exactly what it is. And it all starts with these three uncommon preliminaries. So he calls these the three thoughts that turn the mind. And so what the turning refers to is this 180 degree reorientation of your priorities. You know, you are doing a U-turn. You were one day, you were headed to riches and fame and sexual gratification and whatever, you know, all of the pleasures that samsara promises, you know, and if you just have a big collection of those, then you will have had a meaningful and satisfying life. So that all of a sudden you encounter these three thoughts then, and these three thoughts are enough to turn you around and totally reorient your life. So it is, in Lama Allen's terms, this is as radical and as transformative of your world view as is changing the view from a flat earth to recognizing that there are as many planets as stars in the universe, and that many of these planets are probably habitable. So going from a flat earth to thinking that we are maybe one of many inhabited planets, that's a powerful change of worldview. This is greater than that. this reorientation. So what are these three thoughts? Basically, the first of these is in the Lam Rim called Leisure and Fortune. So this is recognizing that I have everything I need right now. And a little bit later in this evening's class, then we are going to ask ourselves, I have everything I need right now, but to do what? And that is a important question. So you have everything that you need right now, all the leisure and fortune, meaning all of the opportunities. And so here in the one of my all-time favorite, many of you know, Lam Rim texts is this Appendix F that you will find only in, as far as I know, in one edition of all of the Lam Rims that came out of Pabongka Rinpoche and Trijang Rinpoche. So those are most of the Lam Rims, what are called the Lam Rims. Well, I mean, you've got, of course, the Lam Rim Chenmo. But of the Pabongka Rinpoche's Lam Rims, there are four editions that I can think of. But there's only one that actually includes, as far as I know, this Appendix F. And this is the one out of the Mahayana Sutra and Tantra Press from Ken Rinpoche, Lobsang Tarchin, and Artemis Engel. And Geshe Michael Roach also contributed small parts, I think, of that. But, you know, this is Ken Rinpoche, who was the highest ranking Hlorampa Geshe in 1959 when they left Tibet. And so who was one of my first teachers also, one of my Tantra teachers. And so in this Appendix F, this Lam Rim, in the appendix of the second volume of this three volumes, is this Appendix F, which is this spontaneous poem that Pabongka Rinpoche composed to be a guide to recognizing when you have, or how to meditate on the stages of the path, and especially important is what are the signs that you have realized a particular stage of the path and are ready to move on to the next path. Because the whole point of the Lam Rim, when it's done in the way that it was intended, is that you just have this succession of uncontrived experiential realizations of one topic that becomes the foundation for the next topic, but it becomes an uncontrived experiential realization, which means that it becomes a true realization. You don't even have to, not requiring analysis anymore. So here is the standard then for this first one. How do you know whether this is something that you've nailed or not and can move on to shamatha? So here it is. When you are, so there are three things that first of all, the Lam Rim says that you should the way that you approach this topic of leisure and fortune. First of all, you identify what it is, then you recognize its great value, and then you recognize how rare it is to have all these conditions. So here is the standard. When you are overcome with joy, like a pauper who has found a treasure, then you have generated the realization of identifying leisure and fortune. So when you are overcome with joy like a pauper who has found a treasure, and you just think how many people feel just the opposite about their lives, that their lives are just a burden to them. I saw a report yesterday, summary of research on NPR yesterday, of again the relationship between the rise of depression and social media and cell phone use, and the whole thing was startling. But one of the startling statistics was that in this age group of 18 and 19 year old boys, I guess they're boys, young men, the rate of suicide rose 56% since 2008. which corresponds to, you know, the period of social media, cell phones. The first iPhone was introduced 2006. You know, so and it gets worse, especially when you look at adolescent girls. You know, the rates are just astronomical. So a lot of people, you know, and especially it's epidemic among young people now. It's a lot of people don't have, you know, they would be glad to feel this neutrality about their life. You know, yeah, it's okay, you know, so a lot of people are just feel like life is a burden, and that, you know, it's such a burden that it has to, you know, the easiest answer is to end it. But so imagine the absolute polar opposite, 180 degrees from that. Let's just say that you felt the despair and hopelessness of suicidal thoughts. And then you had a 180-degree turn where all of a sudden you had this feeling of being a pauper, overcome, like I had been a pauper, and now I am overcome with joy. Then you get an idea of, you know, the standard of realization of this. So this isn't just for people who are in despair or depressed. You know, this is for people also who, you know, maybe feeling like we're doing okay, but are you feeling this okay? You know, like a pauper, you know, who all of a sudden discovers that your hearthstone is made of solid gold. So that's identifying your leisure and fortune. And so, you know, some of the things that are always mentioned are that we aren't living in a barbarian land. So barbarian here is meant in that Buddhism is unknown. So when you think about it, it wasn't that long ago when we were a barbarian land. So this, I feel like a pauper because I can remember when I, you know, first in the early 1970s became very interested in Buddhism and had experiences that led me to seek out teachings, and I couldn't find anything. You know, it wasn't that long ago. There just wasn't anything around. Herbert Gunther, you know, and some old texts like that. You know, but, and then, you know, slowly things came, and then, you know, since about the 1990s, and, you know, things have just absolutely exploded. So now there are, you know, old information, you know, about 6 years ago, there were 5,000 Tibetan Buddhist centers in North America and Europe. So, you know, it's everywhere now. And so we can have these teachings of Dujom Lingpa brought right to our own neighborhood now. It's, you know, so we're no longer a barbarian land. We were not long ago. But now the most extraordinary teachings, it's, you know, really the most extraordinary teachings of almost any spiritual tradition are available to us now. So, you know, we're no longer barbarians if we avail ourselves of it. You know, and then, so we have authentic teachers, we have the texts, we have friends, spiritual friends, we have the time, we have the resources. You know, so many of us are busy, but we're not so busy that we don't have time for practice. You know, we may not be rich, but we have enough resources to devote ourselves to practice. We have everything that we need. We have enough health. We have enough mental and physical health. You know, we're not at the point that we are going to be at with the mental and physical health. So we've got this, you know, tremendous opportunity right now. So it's good to catalog that. You know, I think this is part of the wisdom of gratitude in positive psychology, you know, and that's such a powerful element of their corpus of practices for getting people to have that optimal number of positive thoughts versus negative thoughts. You know, it's just simply doing gratitude. You know, check in and realize that, you know, God, I've just been dwelling on the negative, but look at everything that I have. So it's not only do I have it pretty good, but I have everything that I need, basically, to achieve my highest goals. And then, so that is identifying, the realization of identifying leisure and fortune. And then you will have realized the great value of leisure and fortune when you become distressed if even an instant of time is vainly spent. So basically, at one point in this discussion also, Dujam Lingpa is talking about slackers. And he's talking about laziness. And he points out that people who are devoted, are working 80 hours a day are slackers, or 80 hours a week are slackers, because they aren't devoting themselves to spiritual practice. You know, so you can devote yourself, you can be really, really busy. So that's not what it's talking about. So when you're distressed at even an instant of time is vainly spent. So you have to know what vainly is, you know. So does this mean that you are just pursuing hedonic pleasure, for instance, or if you're working yourself to death and sacrificing your relationships and your health in order to buy a second home in Gloucester or something? You live in Boston and you want to have a second home in Gloucester, you know. So is that being vainly spent then? And then when you become as upset about being idle for even an instant as another person would be if he spilled a bag of gold dust into a river, then you have realized the difficulty of finding leisure and fortune. So all of these things that we have, living in a land where teachings are available, authentic teachers who are realized are able to teach us directly. We have the physical and mental health. We have the time, the resources, like-minded spiritual friends. All of these things, Alan calls these independent variables. You know, and so like in a scientific experiment. So all of these are independent variables, and to get all of these in one lifetime, you hit the jackpot. And the classic analogy is that the rarity of this is like the blind turtle that is swimming up from the bottom of the Pacific and sticks his head in while he's up there every 100 years. Every 100 years, he swims up from the bottom of the ocean to take a breath of air. And the odds of having the attributes of this life are the same as that turtle when he surfaces, sticking his neck through a life ring that was thrown off the Titanic or something like that, you know, rather than a plastic bag. So really rare, you know, bad odds, you know, of this happening again if you piss it away now. And as one of my dear old teachers and mentors and friends, Rabina Corten used to say, that if you waste your life, this precious human rebirth, just, you know, on fame and riches and that sort of thing, it's like wiping your bum with a $100 bill. So the second point, so this is the first of these three thoughts that have the power to reorient your life so that I have everything I need right now. And then the second is to realize this is a limited time opportunity. You don't know when it's going to end. There were two people that were planning to be at this retreat who aren't. And both of them had things that came up, one today and one yesterday, that they weren't expecting, that, you know, were unfortunate. You know, so all of these things happen all the time. We have this inertia that thinking tomorrow is going to be like today, and it's not. Everybody who gets a diagnosis, everybody who has an embolism and falls over and dies suddenly, Nobody was expecting that the moment before. You know, it happens. You're always going to be not expecting this unless you really prepare yourself for it. You know, and the worst thing is, frankly, to think that. So we know that we're going to die. And the Lam Rim says that is not so difficult to grok, to really have a realization of, okay, I know that I'm going to die at some point, that this is a finite life, but I come from good stock, frankly. My grandfather, Dutch, was 94 and had never been hospitalized. And then he, at 94, he got pneumonia and went into the hospital and died. You know, so that's what I have to look forward to. Right? So we all have that thought, right? I'm going to have a long, full life and, you know, have this slow decline, or maybe not. You know, I'm going to kind of be maintaining the peak of my abilities. I'll be, you know, I might be walking with a cane at 94. But like my grandfather, I'll still be walking down to the pool hall, you know, and shooting pool. He didn't drink beer, but he shot pool. And, you know, and then, but his mind was sharp, you know, he could still recite scripture. You know, extraordinary person. So we all think that. And then you hear a story about, like, there was, a couple of years ago in Boston, a young woman was driving home from her classes. She was a teacher at a primary school, I think it was. And a manhole came through the windshield and killed her. A manhole. It was never explained. There was a lockdown for a day while the city inventoried all of its manholes and made sure that none of them were, you know, that they were screwed down or something. But nobody could explain, as far as I know. A week after, I was still following that story because it was so bizarre. They never explained how that manhole cover became airborne and came through the windshield. So was she expecting that? You know, how bizarre is that? You know, there are so many ways to die, so many few conditions that actually keep this life together. So this is the second thing, to realize that I have everything that I need right now, but it can't last, you know, and I don't know when it is going to last or when it's going to end. And so as Tibetans say, who can say what comes next? The bottom of this cup of tea, even this big cup of tea, or my next life? Who can say? So that's a helpful thing. Every time you're drinking a cup of tea, just to look to the bottom of that and wonder whether you're going to finish it. That's not morbid at all. What it's intended to do is not to make you depressed or anxious, but it's intended to set your hair on fire, you know, to create the sense of urgency. And Dujam Lingpa has to say about that, on this occasion, when you have such a bounty of opportunities in terms of your body, environment, friends, spiritual mentors, time, and practical instructions, without procrastinating until tomorrow and the next day, arouse a sense of urgency as if a spark landed on your body or a grain of sand fell in your eye. So there it is. You know, if a grain of sand falls in your eye, you're not going to think about, maybe I'll get to that tomorrow. So there are then a few other preliminaries that I'm just going to mention and then move on. But these two, you know, especially are intended to create urgency. The third one is basically recognizing the cause and effect, basically the truth of cause and effect, and that suffering has causes, so that So to recognize the truth of suffering and its causes. And then there are three uncommon preliminaries. And the first of these is guru yoga, your relationship to your teacher. The second one is your relationship to your Vajra siblings. And both of these are all about asking yourself the question, what is it in my teacher and in my Vajra siblings that is the basis of designation of who I am seeing these people to be? And so the important point that Padmasambhava and Dujom Lingpa are making with these practices is that what you are doing is, rather than seeing your teacher or your Vajra siblings as ordinary, screwed up, sentient beings prone to mental afflictions, you choose that the basis of designation for this person is their pristine awareness. And so you can do that. You start with your guru, who is somebody that you naturally, probably is the easiest person in your life to project that onto. Okay, I am going to relate to you as pristine awareness. And then you move from there to expand that then to your Vajra siblings and say, okay, now I've got the guru down. I can see my guru as Dujom Lingpa and Samantabhadra, you know, indivisible, Padmasambhava, you know, they're one. Now can I expand that? Now my repertoire, my agility, can I now see all of my Vajra siblings who I have so much in common with? You know, we're all have this similar view of the world. We're all have these same aspirations. Can I see all of these people who I'm close to and feel such an affection for? Can I see these people too? What is the basis of designation of this person? Their pristine awareness. Okay. You know, and we struggle periodically, and that person in the group is pissing me off. You know, they're so irritating, but no, okay, I'm working on it. It's working. Most people in this sangha, I can easily do that with. Okay. Now, then, this is the third of the uncommon preliminaries. So those are the first two of the uncommon preliminaries. The third, then, is all sentient beings. So, first of all, we recognize in the Lam Rim approach that they have all been, and it's more accurately not that they have been, but that they are my mother's, my father's. And then that they have, that basically we're all kin. And that everybody, the tragedy is that all of my kin, they all want to be happy. But because of this third preliminary, the recognition of the causes of suffering, everybody wants to be happy, but we're all creating the causes of suffering. How sad, how tragic that we don't know what are the causes of suffering. And this, because I want all of my kin to be so happy, I just feel this heartfelt desire for everybody who has been so kind to me throughout all of my many lives. I want everybody to have the happiness that I know that they want. But everybody is just creating suffering for themselves. So that's sad. It brings tears to my eyes, you know, is what Dujom Lingpa says. You know, contemplate this until it brings tears to your eyes. And then make the resolve that, you also, like my guru, like my Vajra siblings, are not inherently a sentient being, a screwed up, suffering sentient being. But you are pristine awareness. And unfortunately, you don't recognize that yet, but because you have that, and I know you have that, I am going to work endlessly to help you to recognize, first of all, for me, to recognize my own pristine awareness so that I can prove to you if I can do it, you can do it. And then I'm going to just do everything I can to help you to start creating the causes of your own happiness rather than your own suffering. So those three, then, our resolve, so what we're trying to do now is to create a motivation for this retreat, or to examine a motivation for this retreat. Because shamatha practice is ethically neutral. So there's nothing inherently in shamatha practice that is virtuous. So if you are going to make shamatha practice a virtuous activity, you have to bring the motivation to it. And the motivation is, where, how is it that shamatha fits into the big picture of me achieving my goals of liberation, so that I can then, as I achieve liberation, I can then show everybody else. I can be a cause of liberation for everyone else. So this nianzheng, which is sometimes translated as renunciation, but Alan calls it translates it as the spirit of emergence. So in our motivation for this retreat, don't think of it as striving. You know, I'm striving to get this result. But here is a word that makes perfect sense to me, and that is zeal. So here, this Dujam Lingpa says, the spirit of emergence, renunciation, and spiritual zeal of those who lack these three points are like dew in the summertime. So it's that goosebump renunciation, or sometimes meaning that you've heard an inspiring talk, you know, from one of your lamas, and, you know, ooh, you're all fired up. But then you get dharma'd out, or you get too busy, you know. And so that's, your zeal is like the dew in the summertime. You know, it's easily evaporates because you haven't cultivated these three thoughts. Your zeal is not based on having gone through and actually had realizations of each of these three thoughts. And then the point about zeal also, I think that this is a quality that we really can cultivate and should cultivate for this retreat. Because here is what zeal is. This is from Karma Chagme, a great Mahamudra master, and his book, Spacious Path to Freedom, that Lama Alan translated. The critical point is to practice with zeal. Zeal does not entail mere diligence, but enthusiasm and an enduring quality of delighting in practice. So there you have it. Boy, if you've got that, then it's not drudgery, it's not an obligation. You know, it is not something that you're forcing yourself with discipline to do because you've heard it's good for you, just like castor oil or something, or cod liver oil. You know, hold your nose and meditate. So it is this enthusiasm, this taking this delight in practice. So in order to develop that, then, if you don't feel that, then the preliminaries are the place that you start. And then just in summary, Dujam Lingpa has to say about this, hey, the appearances of this life, including your surroundings and friends, are like last night's dream, and this life passes more swiftly than a flash of lightning in the sky. There is no end to this meaningless work. What a joke to prepare to live forever. Wherever you are born, in the heights or depths of samsara, the great noose of suffering will hold you tight. The root of all mind training and practical instructions is planted by knowing the nature of existence. There is no other way. I, an old vagabond, have shaken my beggar's satchel, and this is what came out. So there you have it. That's what we are going to do for the remainder of our days together while you're not talking, is we are going to try to figure out and fathom this nature of existence. And so it's very helpful to bring a powerful motivation to that. And so let's find a comfortable position in which to meditate. And we will do what is Lama Allen calls, and the point being, you have everything that you need in this life right now. And the question then is, to do what? Begin with the familiar practice of settling the body in its natural state. And this is the point in the meditation when you are overtly relaxing. And breaking the flow of the ruminating mind, releasing it on the exhalation, all the turbulent thoughts, turbulent energy, release them into space, let them leave your body on the exhalation. And relax your body wherever you are holding tension, often in the face, around the eyes, around the mouth, the jaw, the neck. If you feel tension, let your breath be drawn to it as if magnetically, and then release that tension on the exhalation into space. As you release tension and turbulent energy, you discover the natural state of the body. And the relaxation of this natural state allows you to discover the natural state of speech, which is effortless silence. And when this chattering conceptual mind goes quiet, you may have access to a deeper voice, intuitive wisdom, so in this silence and relaxation, consult your intuition, this deep wisdom, with the question, what is my heart's desire for this life? What is my highest potential, my greatest aspiration? If I look back at the end of my life, what is it that will give meaning and purpose the confidence to answer, yes, this has been well lived. Imagine as much detail as you can in this intuitive answer. What is your vision of your own awakening? What does that mean? Is it something that you aspire to? This retreat, we are going to be getting glimpses or indications of pristine awareness. Visualize that pristine awareness now as an orb of radiant light at your heart, the size of a pearl, incandescent. And on the inhalation, with a feeling of loving kindness for yourself, arouse the aspiration. May I truly find my heart's desire. May it become my everyday reality. May it be so. Arouse that aspiration on the inhalation. And on the exhalation, visualize that orb of radiant, pristine awareness. Filling your body with this incandescent light, saturating every cell, eliminating every obstacle to your achievement of your highest potential. Practice with the breath in that way, arousing aspiration and letting the light of your pristine awareness fill your body, delivering the promise. In this practice, we are going to consult our intuition with four questions. This is the first, your big, hairy, audacious goal. The second is recognizing that there are causes and conditions that are necessary to achieve this great aspiration. Some of these conditions are physical and material. There are situations, circumstances in your life material things that you might need? How wonderful it would be if I had everything that I needed to achieve this great aspiration of mine. And arouse that aspiration on the inhalation and on the exhalation. Again, visualize the radiance of your pristine awareness filling your body. And the great joy of, like the pauper discovering a great treasure, recognizing that you have everything. The third question recognizes that some of these causes and conditions that will lead to my great aspiration being fulfilled are internal, they're subjective. So in this state of deep relaxation and silence, listen to for an intuitive answer to the question, in order to achieve this great goal, how would I love to transform? What do I need to give up and what do I need to take up? And again, arouse that aspiration. May I truly transform in the ways necessary. And on the exhalation, let that radiance of pristine awareness fill your body, saturating every cell, eliminating the obstacles to that transformation. And now, while you are in this still, spacious state, link your aspiration for transformation to this retreat. How is it that this retreat can contribute to my transformation, which is so necessary to achieve my great aspiration? And on the inhalation, arouse the aspiration that you do achieve and feel the joy of the pauper who has discovered that he has a great treasure Everything in this retreat is here for you to achieve your goal. You have the perfect outer conditions. And now, while you are resting in this relaxed, silent, listening mode, there's one more question for your intuition. What would you love to give to the world? How would you like to be a cause of other people's discovering and reaching their own highest aspiration? Among your own unique talents, your gifts, which no one else has, in service of your highest aspiration, what is it that you would love to give to the world? And arouse the aspiration that this gift will be a cause of great happiness for all. On the inhalation and on the exhalation, let this radiance of your pristine awareness fill your body and then flood out every pore of your body, filling the space of this room. And continuing right through the walls, to reach all of those you would like to reach. And then release the visualization, release the inquiry. And let this pristine awareness at your heart be the totality of your knowing. So just one last word before I send you off to sleep or to whatever. Tomorrow morning then, when we wake up, our silence will commence. And then at 6:30, so did we find out whether there will be, at 6 o'clock, be hot water for tea or something? So hopefully there will be tomorrow, or we'll get it figured out. You know, it might take one morning to figure it out. But so at 6:30 then, we'll begin with the prayers. And so just in case you don't make it for the 6:30 session, so anyway, I invite you all to come if you are so inclined. And these prayers are, it just gives me goosebumps every time I recite them. And they're, you know, the, you know, preliminary for every morning for me. And sometimes it takes a while to get through them because they are just so rich, and you can stop and think about every line, every phrase, and realize that because this particular prayer that we're doing is my special gift to you. Not that I created it, but comes out of a text, a sadhana, of the lake-born Vajra. So usually you would require empowerment in order to see this, but this is what I think of as an open part of the sadhana, because it's generating refuge in bodhicitta. But so this prayer was created by Dujom Rinpoche, who is incarnation of Dujom Lingpa. And so this, you know, is like going almost, you know, right to the source. And Dujom Rinpoche was just an extraordinary scholar, terma discoverer also. You know, he was Dujom Lingpa, another version of Dujom Lingpa. And his writing is just unbelievable. And this version also is beautifully translated by Lama Ellen and our friend Eva, I think, also collaborated on this, I believe. So just as a teaser, in case you sleep through this tomorrow, this basically is what we're going to be doing for this retreat. In the state of natural rest, I take refuge. There you have it. This is what we are taking refuge in. It is not Buddha, Dharma, Sangha as statuary, as tankas, as something other than me. So when we got a number of us an empowerment in Santa Barbara from Gangtang Tukul Rinpoche of the Pema Lingpa lineage, the highest ranking Dzogchen Lama in Bhutan, the one samaya was, do not look for the Buddha outside yourself. In the state of natural rest, I take refuge. So in the state of natural rest, I take refuge. In the primordial, indestructible nature of existence, the absolute space of the Bindu of clear light, the great indwelling deity. This is what we're taking refuge in. You know, not in something other out there, but in my own potential of transformation. And it's there right now. It's not something that I have to create, but it's something there right now at the essence or the core of every ordinary moment of perception. So this is, you know, what our Dzogchen prayers are telling us, and this is what we're going to try to have empirical, experiential proof of, you know, to have a realization of, to see it for ourselves directly. You know, why not over the course of these 4 days? And so there you have it. Oh, and then generating bodhicitta also is really interesting. This is, you know, so quintessentially Dzogchen. To unrealized beings, the forms created by the delusion of duality the forms created by the delusion of duality, although non-existent, are apparent as the realms of beings. There you have it. With great self-knowing awareness, the taste of equality, I arouse bodhicitta as the naturally free, all-pervasive mind. So that's what we're going to do for 2 weeks, Yeah. We could ask. You know, for our time here. But wouldn't it be great if, you know, we were looking at a longer horizon, you know, that just feel like, okay, let's just relax into this. There's no hurry, you know. But that's basically the program that we're going to try. And in this really, really, it's just absolutely breathtaking, this approach to shamatha and an understanding of what mindfulness is. You know, this is just breathtaking to me. And the potential of this, the link between shamatha and vipassana, using this particular approach to developing shamatha, is, I think there's a lot to explore in that. So that's what we will be undertaking beginning at 6:30 tomorrow or wherever you join us. And so I hope that you will sleep well, pay attention to your dreams, and because your dreams after tomorrow might take on added significance also, because you realize I'll be reading you basically a dream journal before you go to bed, Dujam Lingpa's dream journal. And you realize, there's more to this sleeping state than I may have thought or may have experienced before. So anyway, see you tomorrow in silence. And I am very much looking forward to our time together over the next days.